We're joined this morning by Becky Weinheimer. She wrote a very remarkable book called Converting Kate. Good morning.
Hi.
You write about a teenager by the name of Kate who was raised in a church called the Holy Divine Church. It's not real, but it mirrors the religion in which you were raised. Tell me about that religion.
I was raised in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, often referred to as the Mormons. I think, you know, I say I'm a sixth generation. I think the other day I counted and I might only be a fifth. But anyway, I go way back to Joseph Smith. I, you know, grew up in Utah in a suburb of Salt Lake. 99% of the people in my community were Mormon. And I didn't, you know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and I really thought that people only smoked and swore and drank on TV. I didn't really think that was real. I thought they were just actors. I didn't think. And then when I was in high school, we moved to Arizona at Phoenix, which is what inspired the background for Kate, who has just moved from Phoenix. And it was there that I got my eyes opened and was exposed to different things. Still, the Mormon culture, even when you go to places where it's not entirely Mormon. I had early morning seminary for an hour from like 6 to 7 every morning, or maybe it was 5:30 to 6:30 for 4 years of high school. And, you know, we had activities at night. We had dances. We had roadshows. We did everything with the church. Even through my high school years, I was in Arizona, and I don't know. I didn't take, just because of when I transferred, I didn't take any civics kind of classes. I took English and shorthand and different things. And I was in a public high school, but I didn't know there was a civil rights movement. I didn't know there was a women's rights movement. I didn't know there was a Martin Luther King. There were just a lot of blanks in my life. My father read the newspaper, but it was a church newspaper, and he watched the news, and it was a church news station, and I just didn't pay any attention to it, and he never told me, and I'm sure they would have told things in their own little way. There were big blanks in my life, and I didn't read books. I've made it a little more strict in Kate's religion. I didn't read a lot of books, you know, that weren't written by Mormons. I read a lot of Mormon novels that, you know, the character comes to Jesus and Jesus solves the problem instead of character growth. So it really isn't good fiction. I don't know.
Kate was homeschooled until she started high school. Were you as well?
No, and that's probably because I grew up in all Mormon community. A lot of Mormon mothers choose to do that when they live in other areas, like Kate lived in Phoenix, so that would be a common thing for Mormons to do there. I would say probably less than half do that, but there is maybe 25% of Mormons do it. So I'm giving Kate, you know, even within Mormonism, there is a range, and religion mirrors the more austere, conservative part of Mormonism.
Mm-hmm. It's like Christianity. You have very broad range, too, in the consideration of what constitutes a Christian. What is the difference between a fear-based religion and a faith that can enrich your life?
You know, I wouldn't have even been able to answer that question while I was in the Mormon Church. I didn't know I was in a fear-based religion. I remember when I was trying to get my feet wet and I went to a Unitarian church, you know, I decided to try other churches, and they said, oh, you grew up in a fear-based religion, you poor thing. And I'd never heard that term. I didn't know what it meant, and I had to go home and think about it. Oh, I obeyed out of fear. So, you know, there's a big difference between obeying out of fear and a faith-based religion where it's, I would assume, I'm not really that familiar with that term either, but I would assume that it's you follow your heart or your spirit or the faith inside of you instead of, you know, if you don't do this, you'll go to hell.
I think that you just gave a real good definition of it, since you never heard the phrase before. That was a very good definition. That was a phrase that I just came up with. when I was doing the question.
Well, so. You know, people do use fear-based, so I thought, well, maybe it was something common. You know, I have so many holes in my life. I'm sort of like this, you know, person who's been living in the time warp or something, and I'm coming out, even though I was walking and breathing and living right next to everyone who were doing different things than me.
One of the things that you note as you're telling Kate's story, that the women in the Church of the Holy Divine really were very limited in their options, and they were cheerful to be limited in their options. Do you feel that a fear-based religion is demeaning to women, and if so, why?
Well, most fear-based religions that I know of are run by males. So, yes, I think they're demeaning to women in the first place because you don't have a voice. One of the things I don't think most people know because it's something a part of the Mormon temple ceremony, but women sit on one side, men sit on the other. Of course, it's conducted by a man. Every church meeting is conducted by a man, except for the women's group, which is conducted by women. But in this two-hour session, which I always thought was a nightmare, one of the things that the women all stand and they bow their heads and they agree, bow your head and say yes is what is directed to do, and you're bowing your head and say yes, you will follow your husband in righteousness as he follows Christ. And I just remember the last time I went to the temple, I bowed my head and said no, and I thought, I'm so out of here. Why can't I follow Christ for myself? Why do I have to follow some other person? So I think that is at the very essence, shows what is very telling about what Mormonism is about.
Kate's eyes were opened when she moved to Maine with her mother after the death of her father so that her mother could help run bed and breakfast that was run by her great aunt. At that point, she was exposed to a much more tolerant view of differences, including going to a church that really opened her eyes to the differences in worshiping. How did you get to that precipice where you looked and you said, I can't follow this anymore. My heart doesn't believe it.
Huh. Well, you know, I think all the women's issues had been niggling at the back of me for years, probably since I was a little girl. You know, I was always like, why can't I pass the sacrament? Why is it only boys who get to have the priesthood? And, you know, on and on. You know, they got to go on Super Scout campouts while we were learning to make whole wheat bread. I thought it was much funner to be a boy in our religion. But I probably would have never done anything on my own because the peer pressure is so intense, because the cost is so high when you speak out like I am, that I probably wouldn't have done it. But a specific incident happened, and I hope I can get through it without crying, but I had a daughter. I had three daughters, and now I have two. My oldest daughter died when she was 12. She had cerebral palsy, and she was deaf. And when she was 10, she had a wonderful special ed teacher. I think all special ed teachers are wonderful. But he became like my best friend because we had taken on this task together to help her learn to drive an electric wheelchair. And, you know, it just took patterning every day. We put our hand over hers on the joystick, and, you know, it's a long process. I won't go into it all. But he would spend the half hour he had with her alone, because he had a half an hour with each of his students alone every day, and he would work with her on the wheelchair. He also taught her how to use a computer and play simple computer games with just a very soft button switch, because she, you know, she was physically limited. She couldn't do a lot. And anyway, she did learn to drive, and that was like the happiest day of our life. And he was just as happy as I was when, and she loved Christmas lights, and I put her way back away from the tree, and the next thing I knew was she had crashed into the back of my leg, and she wasn't stopping. She went right into that tree until she could touch all those pine tree needles and everything, and she never forgot how to drive after that. But anyway, when she died, he sat at the foot of her casket while I was greeting people, and he just sobbed for 2 hours. I mean, he loved her nearly as much as I did. And I lived in, after Heidi died, I moved to California, and my family did, and fast forward a few years, and of course, without her to fight for it, there's this big hole in my life, and I'm noticing all these things more. Then we moved to Virginia, but my friends kept me aware of what was going on, and the Mormon Church raised $40 million. They assessed families. The bishop would call people in and assess them a dollar amount to support this bill that would keep gay couples from getting medical benefits. My friend, my daughter's teacher, was gay, and I said, I have to draw the line in the sand. And then I found out, because I was ignorant, I didn't even, you know, they keep you so busy cooking and raising kids and doing all your service projects, you don't even know what's going on, that our tithing and money had gone to other states where they had fought gay legislation. And I was just, all these other things just came to a boiling point, and I said, you know, I have to draw my line in the sand. This is it. I'm leaving. I cannot spit on this good man. I cannot stay in an institution that would call him evil when I know he's nothing but good.
How was that greeted by your family? Did you marry in the church?
Yes, I married in the church. I'm still married to my husband, 27 years. Of course, being a man was treated. I say to people, well, it's like we grew up in the same hotel, but I was in the janitor's closet. He was in the honeymoon suite. You know, of course he liked it. I came to that point, and he was very upset about the whole gay issue, too, because he was very close to this teacher, and he knew what they were doing was wrong. But, you know, still, you don't, you know, everybody says you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And my reply was, the baby's been dead for a long time. And anyway, I told him, basically, it's me or the church. I'm not staying with it. And he chose me, so.
You have two other daughters other than your lost Heidi. Your other girls, how did they deal with the church once you awakened to the fact that maybe this church wasn't necessarily what you wanted to teach your children?
Well, my older daughter was 16, and she became really like a zealot, and she went to her early morning seminary, and she did everything. Fortunately, she took this class in high school. It was on, I have Jamie take it in the, can't think of the name of it right now, when you study all different kinds of religions in school.
Mm-hmm. A religious studies class.
Right. Anyway, she took that, and by the end of it, she was doubting the existence of God. And I will always thank that teacher for opening her mind. You know, she really went full swing. My 14-year-old, I told her, I can no longer allow you to go to a church that demeans women. And when you're 16 and you can drive, if you want to go back, that'll be fine. And, of course, her friends, we'd only moved to Virginia like a year before, so her friends were mostly in the church, and so she was very upset with me. But now she's a senior at NYU, and she never went back to church.
Did you remain close to cousins and friends that you grew up, your own parents, or were they no longer with you at that time?
I probably have 100 or more cousins. I have so many friends, and, you know, I had to go to Utah. I hadn't been there for 10 years, but my mother-in-law was dying, and I just felt I needed to go and say goodbye, and she did die, and I was very upset, and I needed to go up to where my daughter was buried. I hadn't been there in 10 years. She's buried up in the mountains, and I drove up there, and I was in such a state, and my mother-in-law had not quite died, and I just needed to get away from the hospital because of all the prayers, all the things that they were doing, and her death was, you know, going to happen within hours, but I just here I was in Utah where I had family, I had four sisters, I had parents, I had all sorts of brother-in-laws, sister-in-laws, cousins, friends, and I couldn't think of one person I trusted with my soul to drive me up to the mountains. So I just, you know, said a prayer to whoever and prayed I would be able to make it because I was so emotionally distraught. But that tells you I don't have much family left.
So they weren't able to accept you as you were to become?
You know, they would accept me more than I will let them, because their way is not like the Amish, but their way is to pray for me, to send me pamphlets, and I think later in Converting Kate, some of that happens to her, and I just can't take it. And so I've basically said, if you know, it's either me or religion, and you know, no one wants to do that. So I have a civil relationship with most of my sisters now, but it's mostly through email. My sister finally, when she read my book, one of my sisters read my book, and she wrote me and said she wanted to talk to me about it. And within 5 minutes, I was yelling at her. I was screaming in her, and, you know, I went off on this tirade, and I said, I just can't be a nice person to people who are so brainwashed, because it's too haunting to me to see what I was like.
Well, the book is haunting. What did your sister think about it? Did she feel betrayed somehow?
Well, because I started yelling, I don't really know that much. She said it made her feel very sad, and that she was praying for me. So those are two things I got out of it. But we quickly decided we had just had to talk about neutral things, or it was not going to go anywhere. So we talked about what her kids are doing, what mine were, you know, favorite recipes, just neutral topics. And that's the only way. I have two cousins who have reached out to me, and they just, my one cousin just wrote last week. We haven't talked, and we went to high school together, and I haven't talked to him in over 20 years, and he found my website and found out about the book, and he has written me. He's a very active Mormon, and he just hasn't mentioned it, but he knows I'm an author and everything, you know. He teases me about, well, I hope I'm not keeping you from your writing or something, famous author, you know, so I know he knows, and he comments on the pictures of our family that he saw on the website, but to his credit, he isn't overtly trying to reconvert me.
I am at the point in the book now where Kate just got a letter from her cousin along with pamphlets, and they're praying for her to come back into the fold. There's a part of me that feels a little sorry for Kate's mom. She feels that this daughter of hers, who she's raised so faithfully, that she's losing her on some level as Kate rebels against some of these restraints. Could you address your feelings on teenage rebellion and why it's not always necessarily the bad thing that as moms we might see it?
I think that's a great question. In fact, when my girls, they were at that age, and I became so angry at my mother, that which is one of the reasons I wrote this. How could she have raised me like this? Because she was very much like Kate's mother, you know, and I was just so angry, and I didn't speak to my mother for probably 7 years. I finally contacted her after I wrote this book, because writing it had healed so much of the anger in me that and now we have a very polite relationship. And but when my girls would be angry with me, and you know, I said, "Good, do it now. I was such a good teenager. Get it out now. You can be angry at me now, because maybe you won't not talk to me for 10 years, you know? Mm-hmm. You're supposed to rebel when you're a teenager. I did it too late, you know? Get it out now." So I think rebellion, finding who you are and allowing your children, your teenagers to do that, is just part of how they have to break away. You know, if they agree with everything you do, if they don't see themselves as separate individuals, how are they going to ever go out on their own and be their own individual? I think it's more an expression of trying to find their identity than it is a rebellion.
And I think you and I, we're both mothers, and I think we need to be clear on this. We're not advocating going out and doing things that are dangerous.
No.
We're advocating
dialogue.
Dialogue. Questioning what you're saying are long-held beliefs, saying, well, why is it that way? That's good.
Right. And not enforcing, you know, the old stereotype, you have to do it my way or no way, you know. And then grounding teenagers and all those things, because then that leads to harder rebellion, and then they sneak out, and then they do lie and do horrible things. I figure by the time they're a teenager, hopefully you've got rules in place because you can't make them. Of course, I did tell my daughter she couldn't go back to church till she was 16, but I choose my ultimatums very carefully. She didn't have any other ultimatums. So, you know, I think you can get away with one or two, but you can't be too strict on them.
You also gave her the choice.
Of
going back when you're 16, you can do that. I won't stop you. Or do you find the rise of the religious right to be a troubling trend?
Yes, I do. I think because so many people politically, when the religious right, I know when we lived in Virginia, a lot of people were told from the pulpit, and they weren't Mormons, but they were different religions, and they were told from the pulpit how to vote, and they did it without reading about the issues, checking out the issues, just following in blind faith their leaders. That's what I find very scary, because we're letting someone else make the decisions for us and help run our country. And the whole thing, you know, well, it's God-fearing man in the White House. Well, why can't it be, you know, a Mother Earth-loving woman in the White House?
Or a Mother Earth-loving man.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's an element of laziness in why we allow ourselves to be led like that? Maybe it's easier than thinking the troubling thoughts and the deep thoughts required to think for ourselves.
I think it's comforting. You know, the group of people I would like to shake and wake up are Mormon women, you know, of course. But they're my worst enemies. They're the ones who are the harshest critics of me. And I think that's because it is a safe place for them. They don't have to think. They aren't responsible. And I guess it's more comfortable than rocking the boat. I don't know. I really don't know, because I chose to leave.
How would you say your life is now?
Oh, gosh. I feel like I was like in a coma or something, or a zombie, and I've woken up, and every day I get to decide what I'm going to do, what I'm going to wear, what I'm going to read, what I'm going to eat and drink. I mean, it's just every aspect of my life I get to decide. And I've discovered who I am instead of this robot who's following all the do's and don'ts, checking off the checklist. I've discovered who I am, which I never knew. So many layers of the brainwashing and following the rules hide I wasn't anyone who was ever excited about sewing or cooking, and so I never really felt that good about myself because I couldn't do things very well. And then I couldn't even have a big family because of my oldest daughter, you know. So, you know, I failed in everything Mormon women are supposed to be good at. So I like it. You know, and when I went to Vermont College soon after I'd broken away, and I was with all these other women, mostly women and some men, but that were just really cool, and we were alike, not because we all followed the same religion, because we all liked to write and read. And I just found that so wonderful that I found these soulmates who were truly soulmates at the core. Not just because we have this outer plastic that made us look alike.
I have one more question. We're speaking with Becky Weinheimer. She wrote a very intriguing book called Converting Kate. My favorite character in the book so far, which I'm halfway through, is Aunt Catherine. Is she based?
I knew you were going to say that.
Is she based on anybody in particular?
Yes.
She is.
She is. I had a dear friend in California. Her name's Irene, and she's in her mid-80s now, and when we lived in California twice, and the first time we lived there, we were only there for like 6 months. My husband was on a temporary work assignment, and I met her then when I had my daughter was still alive. And when I came back, she was the only one who seemed to understand. A lot of Mormons were like, oh, you must be so happy. She's whole now. She's walking with God. She's no longer struggling. And they wouldn't even allow me to grieve, but she knew my heart was broken, and she reached out to me, and she would just leave. She lived about a mile away. She would leave little, she still does. I get about 2 or 3 envelopes a month with all these newspaper clippings, things she thought I might be interested in, and she just sent them to me, gave them to me, and started sharing books with me, and just opened up this whole world.
I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today about your book, Converting Kate. Where is it available?
Mostly, it's in Barnes & Noble's independent bookstores carry it, and of course you can get it on Amazon or through Viking's website.
So basically any major bookstore.
Right.
Do you have a website yourself?
Yes. My website is www.Becky, B-E-C-K-I-E, Weinheimer, Weinheimer.org.
I want to thank you again for talking with us today about this very intriguing, provocative, and enjoyable book.
Thank you.